Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here to talk about taxes. Great time of year to talk about taxes. And I'm a tax type. Ed Zirndorfer, enrolled agent. Now, I don't know if you all know what enrolled agents are, but they're really hard to pass that test, and they're enrolled to practice before the IRS. Ed is an enrolled agent, federal benefits expert, tax expert, financial planner. You're CFP, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. What aren't you? Yeah, I mean, the letters would trail your last name.
I'm not a lawyer.
Okay. Ed's not a lawyer.
Do not give legal advice.
Okay, so we're here. We've already got two emails, and actually three emails, but let's start off with the very basics. When we talk about taxes, I don't want to get into the weeds at all, but when you start to talk about tax brackets and this and that, let's just start at the top. When we file a tax return, the first thing we look at, correct me if I'm wrong, is called gross income. What's gross income, Ed?
Gross income, Bob, is your total income. Add up your gross salary. You might have a pension, interest income, dividend income, capital gain income, rental income, lottery winnings. When in doubt, it is income.
Right. I in class, I liken it to a funnel, and you just pour all this stuff in the neck of the funnel, and then it comes out it just filters on down. But some of those things you mentioned, like Social Security, and depending on the size of your income, this is almost algebraic, it could be taxed at three different levels, or not taxed at one and taxed at two. That's a mind-boggling calculation to make manually.
Yes, I advise anyone who does their taxes always to use some type of software or go to a professional.
Right.
Trying to do it by hand can be very challenging.
Sure. And salary, our listening audience can put money into the thrift and have their salary reduced for tax purposes and go into a savings account called the thrift. Retirees generally do not pay tax on the full amount of their annuity. Not generally, they don't. There's a small piece that's non-taxable. So all this kind of stuff that goes into gross income, some of it may be left at the starting gate, which is good, that it would never even get to gross income. Isn't that right?
That is correct. So at least for now, it's not going to get to gross income. Maybe down the line, for example, you mentioned contributions to the thrift saving to the traditional TSP as opposed to the Roth TSP. That portion of the salary that goes to the traditional TSP is not taxed now, but it will eventually when it's taken out of the traditional TSP.
Yeah, there was a guest on the show, the director of the thrift. He had a great comment. It's under the concept of pay me now or pay me later. And pay me now is putting money into the Roth because you pay taxes now. Pay me later, the traditional TSP, I'll get a tax benefit, but when I take it out, I'll pay later.
Well said. And it brings up an important point, Bob, that everyone's thinking about their taxes now, but they have to think about what's going to happen in the future. Even when they're retired, what their tax consequences will be with their pensions, both from the standpoint of the federal government, and if they happen to live in a state that has a state income tax, from a state tax standpoint as well.
Okay, we talk about that in class, and when one retires, hopefully the COLAs will continue, maybe not as robust, maybe, but you have one line going up. If you were to look at this on a graph, the income is going to be rising modestly, but your tax deductions are probably going down quicker. We don't have as much state and local income tax for those that do. We probably don't pay as much in mortgage interest and the like. So there's this gap, and the term tax shelter comes into being. But we don't want to go near tax shelters until we get – we haven't got past gross income already. So, all right, gross income is probably everything you can imagine and then some. And it would also include your ability to regulate some of that by putting money into a traditional TSP. Now, once we move forward from that, that's – the first major block, they have things called adjustments. To be fair for most folks, it's hard to get. But what is an adjustment?
An adjustment to one's income is the amount of money that someone contributes to or I could say contributes to, and as a result is able to deduct that contribution from the gross income. So the best way to describe it is to give an example. If one is eligible to contribute to a traditional deductible IRA, because there are really three types of IRAs, traditional deductible, traditional non-deductible, and Roth IRAs. If one puts money, contributes to a traditional deductible IRA, then the amount of the contribution will be deducted from one's gross income. So that's an adjustment to, it's an example of an adjustment to one's income. Another example is a contribution to a health savings account that are available to most federal employees. They are able to contribute to health savings accounts, and in so doing, they will reduce the amount of their gross income. So those are two examples. There are other things that are adjustments to income. For example, if you make an early withdrawal on one's certificate of deposit, you open up a CD at the bank, you open up a one-year CD, and you get a 1% rate if you're lucky. And after 6 months, you're saying, well, the bank down the street is offering 2%. I think I'll break this CD and go to the other bank. Well, most banks are going to will charge what is called a penalty, early withdrawal penalty, and that early withdrawal penalty is an adjustment to one's income. Not to be recommended, though. Not recommending that people go out, open up CDs, break them, and pay a penalty and be able to get some tax savings out of it.
Agreed, especially with today's rates. They're small enough as they are. All righty, there's another one in there. I think it's called a moving expense, and it's if somebody moves to change job locations, that's kind of key. So they have to go to work after they move, but some people retiring and moving might want to go to work if for no other reason than to get the moving expense, or somebody on the other side of the work spectrum, they move to take a job at the beginning of their career. So I would say that's somewhat overlooked. And even within the federal sector, if one is transferred from one location to another, uncle usually picks up the tab. Sometimes they call that the relocation income tax allowance, but it doesn't cover everything. I think one of the more common things it doesn't cover is the full amount of the weight. And if you're not reimbursed, then you could claim that as an adjustment.
Well, it's very interesting you mentioned that about federal employees, because when I teach tax planning seminars for the NITP, and many times I do seminars for new employees and talk about deductions, and we talk about the moving expense deduction. The first question I get is, well, don't you have to itemize in order to get the deduction, the moving expense deduction? The answer is no. It used to be way back when. I think, Bob, you have a little more experience in this area than I did. Way back when it used to be.
I remember when they first wrote the code.
They used to have the moving expense deduction as an itemized deduction. Then they moved it over to as an adjustment to one's income. I guess that's why they call it the moving expense deduction, because it's moved from one form to another.
Okay.
On the IRS
form. A little tax humor there, Ed.
Okay. Well, it is an adjustment to one's income. So what I tell the new employees especially, I ask them, well, is this your first job? They say, yes. Where'd you come from? Well, I graduated from school last year. And here you're, let's say, working here in Washington, D.C. Where did you go to school? Oh, I went to Ohio State in Columbus, Ohio. Well, that's more than 50 miles away. Therefore, when you move to Washington to take your first job, your moving expenses, whatever was not reimbursed, are considered to be moving expenses. And they're like, gee, I didn't know that. I says, well, just get together all your moving expenses, including the cost of moving your goods here. Maybe you had to go to find your first apartment. You know, you had to make a special trip here. And maybe you had to spend overnight to get here, you know, you drove here. So all these expenses incurred in moving to Washington, D.C. are considered to be moving expenses. But again, the key is it has to be more than 50 miles away. Okay.
Right.
So if you graduated from the University of Baltimore, which is about 40 miles from Washington, it's not going to work. It has to be more than 50 miles away.
Okay. And again, this is an adjustment. So let's just kind of, gross income is all your income. And then you're allowed to reduce that income before you pay taxes, but in kind of three stages. One stage is this adjustment comes right off the top. It has nothing to do with itemized deductions and then personal exemptions. All righty, now, gross income minus adjustments, oddly enough, is called adjusted gross income. Adjusted gross income looked at another way is the hub of the wheel of the tax return. The entire return spins off of that. It impacts numbers above it. It knocks numbers off the return, and it also reduces itemized deductions. We won't call it a bad thing, but it, if we're doing history, that came into effect about 1986. But let's now travel beyond adjustments, and we'll talk about deductions. People say, you know, I need more deductions. But deductions have really been on a diet for the last number of years, and it isn't, they aren't what they once were. So let's take a walk through. The first one I think that comes to mind is medical, and I don't want to preface anything you're going to say, but if there's one deduction we don't want, it's medical.
That is correct, Bob, because one has to have a certain amount of out-of-pocket medical, dental, vision expenses that exceed a percentage of one's, again, adjusted gross income, as you mentioned a few moments ago, in order to be able to include them as part of one's itemized deductions. Just want to mention, for 2012, it's the amount that one has to exceed one's adjusted gross income in medical, dental, vision expenses is 7.5% of one's adjusted gross income, but starting for January 1st, 2013, it goes up to 10% of one's AGI if you're younger than 65. People who are over 65 get a little bit of a break for the next 4 years. But for the listeners who are younger than 65, for the year 2013, you have to exceed 10% of one's adjusted gross income.
So let me make sure I understand that. Let's say my adjusted gross income is $60,000. And it's 2012. If I multiply that by 7.5, Andrew, what's that, $4,500? Andrew says yes. All righty. My medical unreimbursed expenses would have to exceed $4,500. But next year, this year, when we're doing our 2013 tax returns, about a year from now, that number, same income, $60,000, but now it has to exceed $6,000. And again, I hope nobody ever qualifies for this, but it is such a high number.
Now, that is correct. Hopefully, most federal employees are not going to be in that category,
because they have such good health care plans. All righty. Beyond that, let's go to taxes. Not income taxes, but there's certain types of taxes here that you can subtract from your adjusted gross income to lower your income before it is subject to income tax. Now, what kind of taxes are in here?
We're talking about state and local income taxes and state and local sales taxes. Now, you can't do both. You get a choice of one or the other, whatever comes out to be the higher.
Okay, let me ask you a question here. If I live in a state with no state income taxes, then it's pretty easy what I'm going to do. I'm going to look for my sales taxes, and they would include just normal sales taxes on stuff that's purchased, but it also would include big ticket items, furniture, used car, new car, and all those get added together.
Yes, that is correct. And if the state, as you mentioned, has no state income tax, state and local income tax, then you are going to be deducting your state and local sales taxes. Bob, I just want to mention there are two states that have neither state and local income taxes or state and local sales taxes. I believe it's New Hampshire and Alaska.
Yes.
So what do the people in those states do?
Smile.
Well, the IRS has a table they can go to, because the IRS has a standard sales tax table they could use. So just so if any of our listeners out there are listening from Alaska or New Hampshire, the IRS has not forgotten about you.
Okay. Now, how about We're trying to cover all stages of one's career here, beginning, mid, and pre-retirement. But let's say we are retired and we live in a state, and we live in a state that's very tax-friendly with regards to the annuity. So there could be a large exclusion from state income tax. Therefore, it would reduce the income tax. They might as well look at the sales tax, because they get the higher of the two. And if one of the bigger numbers on the return, their annuity is not subject to state income tax, they might in fact enjoy the benefit of higher sales tax. Did I say that right, Ed?
That's correct. That's correct. So one has to really look at the two. But I guess the tough thing for most people is, how do I know what I paid in state and local sales taxes? I mean, it's obvious what you pay in state and local income taxes. It's deducted from your annuity or your paycheck. How do you know what you paid in state and local sales taxes, though?
They have charts, don't they?
They have charts. IRS has a publication. I believe it's IRS Publication 600. There's a standard chart. But that tells that in that publication it says what every resident of every state pays typically in sales taxes. One is allowed to add to what's in that publication the sales tax paid on big ticket items like cars or appliances, and then you can compare that to what one pays in total in state and local income taxes.
Okay, so within the tax arena, we have state and local income taxes or sales taxes. How about if we own a piece of property or properties? Do we get to deduct the real estate taxes?
And we also have property tax, real estate taxes that you pay on your house, or you pay on land. You may own some investment property. As far as rental property is concerned, we are able to deduct it, the property taxes we pay on the rental property. However, it's not reported as part of one's itemized deductions normally. It's reported on a separate schedule, one's tax return, Schedule E, rental income.
It goes into gross income, right, Ed?
It goes
into your bones connected to the whatever. Okay, and then I think there's a third one. Not everybody has this, but personal property taxes.
The states that impose personal property taxes, there are some. One is allowed to deduct the personal and property their personal property taxes. They pay typically on their cars and their possessions.
All righty. Then we go to interest. Interest itemized deductions. Gone are the days of credit cards, correct?
Correct.
Gone are the days of interest on a car loan not financed by a home equity line. But what's the big one there? Home mortgage interest, right?
Home equity.
Yeah.
Line of credit.
All right. So I think interest is interest. But we're going to go back. We're just laying the groundwork here. But then we're going to go through some of the more commonly overlooked itemized deductions. But first, we have to define what is an itemized deduction. And then we work our way to charitable donations. They're pretty, I would say, pretty simple. You donate money to a organized charity, if you will, and you would expect to get an acknowledgement back. And then non-cash valuation of the things that people give away. How do you value that, Ed?
Very conservatively. One should there is this concept of thrift shop value, but one should not really. One should be careful how they do it, and don't go overboard as far as how one values something. I believe I don't have it off the top of my head. There is a website where you actually can get a value of something you donated to a charity, and the IRS will accept that.
Okay. All righty, and then we have an area called miscellaneous. And when we do this in class, people say, really, I could deduct that? But miscellaneous is much like medical. It has to exceed a certain percentage of one's income. If I'm not mistaken, it's 2%.
That's correct.
But usually what's in miscellaneous, correct me if I'm wrong, is something to do with somebody either making money or their profession.
That's correct. Included as part of one's miscellaneous itemized deductions would be things like employee business expenses. If one has to go out and pay money for in the course of their job, those expenses like books and supplies, computers, they're using it, you know, in their job, and they paid out of pocket, they're not being reimbursed for it, would it be considered to be employee business expenses? Interesting, since teleworking is so popular among federal employees now, those employees who set aside a portion of their house and they work from there, and they have to go out and buy a computer and things like that in order to work from home, the what they pay for their computer, software, things like that would be considered to be, for example, employee business expenses.
Okay, and would also include, like we say, to quote, make money. We're not talking about necessarily big money, but we might subscribe to Money Magazine if for no other reason than to check the best CD rates in the country, or to look at different people's ideas about investments. It could be whatever that thing is, TurboTax, a commercial software package, if you were to go to a tax preparation outfit, or if not, just to sit down and say, what am I missing here? Not necessarily to have the tax return prepared. I don't want to sound self-serving here. And it would also include things like reservists that have to maintain their uniform for the monthly drills, haircuts, etc. So all these things could be included in the miscellaneous deduction area. people hear this, get excited about it, but remember it has to exceed 2% of your
adjusted gross income,
the hub of the tax return. All righty, so at the end of this exercise now, we started with total income. We looked for every way to keep legitimately money out of it. Then we looked for any adjustments that we might be able to claim, which is going to be hard for most people listening to the show. Beyond that, then we have the itemized deductions for medical, which I hope you never qualify for, but it does have to exceed 1% of your adjusted gross. Yes, we have real estate taxes, state and local income taxes, sales taxes. We have charitable donations, and we have this miscellaneous maybe because it has to exceed that percent. And then we get to claim something called personal exemptions. Now, we're talking about 2012. We're going to leave 2013 go for just a second. So a personal exemption is somebody that you could claim as a personal exemption.
Personal exemption.
And after we subtract those things from adjusted gross, we arrive at a figure called taxable income. Now, let's be real with taxable income. There are only four filing statuses. Either you file married, filing, joint. If you happen to be married, everybody isn't married. If we're not married in a minimum, then we're going to file as a single individual. However, we might be a single individual that provides the household for somebody, and they qualify for something called head of household. Now, if you step back and look at this, if you look at the lowest rate, it's joint. If you look at the next lowest rate, it's head of household. If you looked at the next highest rate, it's single. And if, I won't say unfortunately, because there might be good reasons to file married filing separately, which is the fourth status, that tax rate's pretty rough. But when you look at tax rates, there's sometimes a myth that says, gee, my friend went into the higher tax bracket and lost money. That's pretty much not going to happen. The first tax rate, if you will, is 10%. Most people are going to blow through that pretty quickly with just a portion of the year's income. And the next rate is 15. But what I'm getting at is the first group of dollars is taxed at the least level. Any amount that goes over that gets taxed at the higher level. And then the next higher level is 25%. So it's kind of like pouring the proverbial water into the proverbial bucket. Once the first bucket is filled, the only thing that spills over and is taxed at the higher rate is what spills over. They don't go back and retax the money in the bucket. And then it can go to 28, and then it can go to 33. But I mean, then you're getting up into the stratosphere a little bit here when you get to 35. And again, we're talking about 2012. We're not talking about 2013. 2013 is a discussion we'll do later. Is that the way it works, Ed?
That's correct. They call the progressive, you know?
Yeah.
The kind of progressive tax system.
And if you were to look at your own personal rate and you're in a state that has a state income tax, you got to add that to the federal. So let's say you're in the 15 or the 25% federal bracket and you're in a state with a 5% tax bracket, the combined hit is as little as 20 and probably 30 or better on each dollar that gets into the next higher level.
We're really talking about here, Bob, is what is called the ordinary tax rates. This is just one, the different categories of tax rates, but this is called the ordinary tax rates.
Okay.
Okay, in which your income is being taxed at. And the rate that you're at is basically when they say, well, you're paying tax at 35%, it's really on your last dollar of taxable income. You know, it's not going to be 35% on the whole thing. It's just on your basically on that, on your last dollar of income, what percentage you're at.
Absolutely. Already, with the major change in the tax law that was kind of passed when January 1st, IRS wasn't ready to process tax returns, and to be frank, I'm not so sure that the forms could be printed by then. And I just read last week, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, the IRS this week is going to accept returns that include educational credits where they couldn't file them before this week. And for those that might have a rental property or even a small business, if it had a depreciation schedule, you couldn't file that until this week.
Yeah, the IRS was delayed by about 2 weeks. Normally, the filing season starts around January 15th. This year, it started on January 30th. But even with that, there were certain forms that could not be filed until this week. And you mentioned the educational tax credits. So now, as of this week, I guess anyone who wants to file can, assuming they have all their stuff and it's correct.
Okay. And we're talking early February. I believe today's February 11th, so people maybe completed their tax return and couldn't file it. Maybe that's good because we'll give them some tax tips. And for the rest, let's take a look at some potentially overlooked tax deductions currently for the year 2012. We talked about state sales tax, and we went off on a little bit of a tangent there, that sales tax could even be beneficial to somebody in a state that has a state income tax. It's the higher of the two, as you mentioned, but sometimes people might benefit because they bought a big ticket item. They bought a car, and they were in a state with either a low bracket or they were in a state that had a preferential treatment to their income, be it salary or be it annuity. And then there's a thing in here, reinvested dividends. Ed, I thought that the IRS told the brokerage houses that they had to keep track of this.
In terms of
the quote basis, you know, in other words, if a dividend was reinvested, then the person paid taxes on it, but that's as if they bought a fractional share of the stock.
Correct. And this is basically for people who ultimately sell their stock or their mutual funds, that they have a better idea what their cost basis is. It used to be one had to sit down and calculate. If they sold a mutual fund or a stock, they had to figure out what their cost basis was. And I'm sure you remember those days, Bob, where the client would come in the office and give you a 1099-B showing the gross proceeds from the sale of the stock or mutual fund, and you would ask the client, well, do you have any idea what you paid for it? And the reaction would be, I have no idea. I'll leave it up to you. You figure out what the cost basis is. And here you're going to be stuck with globs and globs of paper. Hopefully they kept records of what they did through the years. And if they didn't, you got a little problem. But now, as a result of a change in the law, the brokerages are furnish cost basis information for, it started actually last year, for people who own stock, but for 2012, the brokerages have to furnish information for the cost basis of mutual funds that were sold.
Okay, so that's an overlooked thing. At least I find that, and you find it with the clients. Did you reinvest? Yeah. Well, you can add that to your cost basis to increase the loss or decrease the gain. Out-of-pocket charitable donations. Now, we're talking about small things here, but if somebody does some charitable work and pulls some money out of their pocket for supplies, or, you know, they take the kids to a place to eat after an event, but that should not exceed a certain amount of money, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
All right. And also, if they drive for charitable purposes, it's 14 cents a mile.
14 cents a mile.
Okay, the small, but everything helps, especially when you talk. This comes right off the top of your top tax bracket. Student loan interest paid by mom and dad. How in the heck does that become deductible?
The student loan interest deduction is an adjustment to one's income. And the interest that is paid on student loans, like the parent plus loans, or if a parent took out a loan with a bank to pay for college education of their son or daughter, the interest is paid during the year up to $2,500 as a limit, would be considered to be an adjustment to one's income. However, it is subject to an adjustment gross income limitation. Okay, that adjustment to income was due to expire at the end of 2000. It did expire at the end of 2011, and Congress renewed it for 2012. But anybody who paid any parents who paid student interest on student loans, just beware, it is subject to an AGI limitation.
Okay, there we go back to the AGI again, the hub of the return, impacts numbers above and below it. Not that many of our listeners are self-employed, but they might have a small side business, and if they have Medicare premiums, they can include that as self-employed adjustment right off the top. On the front of the return.
Together with their health insurance.
Yes.
Premiums.
All righty. Refinance point. I mean, there's an awful lot of refinancing going on today. And if you pay points when you get it, you amortize it over the loan period. But what if we had refinanced, say, a few years ago when we thought that rates were at their rock bottom and we paid some points and we have to spread them out over the period of the loan, but here we are 5 years later, and we're going to go after another refinance, but we haven't written off the old points. Can we deduct them?
Yes, any unamortized points on a loan can be deducted in the year that one refinances, gets a new loan. So the unamortized portion of the points can be included as part of one's mortgage interest deduction.
Great. All righty. Then there's something called the American Opportunity Credit. I think this is really aligned with college and if you will, higher education. It could be trade school, if I'm not mistaken. And it's a lot of money, isn't it? I mean, this is a credit is like a real dollar. It's not a tax-deductible dollar.
Well, Bob, we were talking earlier about how one derives one's taxable income. We went through the whole formula, but we did not mention anything about my favorite type of deduction is a credit, because that's a dollar-for-dollar reduction of one's tax liability. And if one can get a hold of some good tax credits, it would be really good, and one of which is the American Opportunity Tax Credit, which is a credit for for money paid for tuition and fees, books and supplies for undergraduate years, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior at a college, university, or at a trade school.
Okay, so,
but it's up to. But again, it's subject to an AGI limitation.
All right, and everything except maybe energy credits.
The energy credits are not subject to one's AGI. That one can get a credit as much as $500 on energy improvements made to one's home, such as putting in storm windows, storm doors, new energy efficient furnace and air conditioner, up to $500. But if one used that previously in the last 5 years, you can't take it again.
That's what I thought. All righty, Ed. We walk through here. Let's open up the phone lines. We've got a couple few emails, let's do the emails first before we do the open line. You have an email there. It really isn't on taxes, but it was a good question regarding the number of pay periods within a particular year.
Yes. Question is this. A coworker who is a fairly new federal worker asked me a question the other day, assuming that as a long-term federal worker, I would know the answer. However, I did not know the answer. In fact, the person said, I knew the answer one time, but I could not come up with it when it was asked. I hope you'll be able to help. Okay. So here's the question. Why is our gross yearly salary less than our biweekly salary multiplied by the number of pay periods in a year, usually 26? And here's the answer. They're probably looking at their 2012 gross salary and dividing it by 26. Every 11 years, federal workers have 27 pay periods. It happened to be in the leave year 2012, there were 27 pay periods. This year, 2013, for the next 10 years, including 2013, there'll be 26. So that's why it does not mesh up to 26 for the year 2012. You had to use 27.
Okay, very good. Now let's get into some of the tax questions. There was one, and the individual bought the house from mom and dad, right? Or from mom or from dad. It doesn't make any difference. And the house cost X dollars many years ago. It had gone up in value. And at the time that it was sold to the three children, it was sold to the three children for a dollar. Most likely, it was worth more than a dollar at the time. That's my wild guess. All righty. So then the question would be, when the house is sold, and now the house is going to be sold for a little over $50,500, what happens?
Assuming the children did not live in the house, because when one sells one's principal residence, this is a place someone has been living in at least two out of the last 5 years, one is able to exclude up to $250,000 of capital gain, that's single, or $500,000 if one is married, filing jointly. But that's not the case here. The children probably were not living in the house, which means they must pay the full capital gains tax on the profit. So if they sold it for what, $50,000, Mom?
Mm-hmm.
If the cost basis is $1, they're going to have to pay capital gains tax, federal and state, on $49,990 of capital gain income.
could they search their records and say, well, since we bought it in 2005 and one of the parents lived in it, I believe, the one that sold it lived in it, but if the kids help mom or dad out by buying a refrigerator, redoing the kitchen, putting some more insulation to keep them warm, couldn't they add that to the dollar that they paid for the house in determining the final profit?
I don't believe things like adding appliances will add to the cost basis. I mean, it have to be some very significant capital improvements. If they add an addition to the house, put on a new roof, something like that, would have to be a significant capital improvement in order to add to the original cost basis.
Okay, and what if they were to put in special ramps because they weren't as mobile as they were before? Redid the bathroom, for example, so that they could more easily take care of themselves. I believe that's an improvement.
That would be a capital improvement.
All right. And anything else? I mean, if they spent some money on the outside of the house with regards to bushes, trees, put a tree in to make it a little bit more shady, put it something in the backyard so mom could enjoy the backyard a little bit better. So they're really going to have to scratch. But then, unfortunately, as you indicated, the cost of that house regarding a sale is $1 plus whatever we can find that was done permanently to the house to make mom more comfortable.
And hopefully they'll have the records. They have to have actually formal records in order to, in case of audit, to prove that they made these improvements.
Okay. All righty. So that's one tax question. There was another one, and it involves, unfortunately, somebody passing away, a parent, and the other parent inherited the other parent's IRA. So the question then is, the remaining parent, what can they do? Can they take that money and put it into a Roth IRA? And let me read the specifics. Dad died leaving his traditional IRA to mom. I don't think mom will need these assets, and I'm wondering whether she should convert them to a Roth IRA. If she agreed to convert the IRA, would the funds forever be treated as after-tax assets? As they pass through multiple generations, if merely retained in a Roth IRA? It's a two-part question. Let's do that one first.
Mom is certainly able to take the inherited IRA from her deceased spouse and convert it to a Roth IRA. And at that point, once she converts it and pays the tax due, it will be, the assets coming out of it will be tax-free. But I got to mention something to Bob, that when one converts a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, there is a five-year waiting period before one can start taking the money out. It's, in other words, they're called
tax-free.
Tax-free. It's called a qualified distribution. In the case of a converted IRA, there is a five-year holding period in order to make a qualified distribution. She could take the money out within the 5 years, but she'd have to pay tax.
Well, let's say that this amount was $10,000 and the emailer can multiply this by whatever the number is. And they convert to $10,000 and they pay the tax on the $10,000. But then, really, they did need a couple thousand dollars, so they go into the Roth IRA and pull out a couple thousand. If I'm not mistaken, the first dollars coming out of a Roth are considered to be the first money going into the Roth. Therefore, there wouldn't be any tax until they pulled out the original $10,000.
Well, the question is, was this a deductible traditional IRA? Because if it was a traditional deductible IRA, that means they're paying tax on the whole thing.
Right. I got to figure it is. If I kind of know the emailer, and I'm pretty sure the parents were of the era where there was no Roth.
So they have to pay tax.
Yeah.
Now, I just want to follow up on what I said, that if mom does do the conversion and she says, okay, I'm not going to touch it for 5 years, I'll leave it alone. But suppose she passes away and she's going to name her children as beneficiaries of this converted Roth IRA. When can the children take it out without, in terms of doing a qualified distribution? The five-year holding period still pertains here. They're going to have to wait until that five-year period of down. Now, the five-year meter is not reset once they inherit it. It goes back to the year that she converted it. And by the way, it goes back to January 1st of the year that she converted it. You don't have to. It doesn't go by what day of the year you convert. It goes back always to January 1st.
Okay, so if this happened today, February 11th. And February 12th, we made the conversion. The five-year holding period started January 1st, 2013.
So as of January 1st, 2018, a qualified distribution can be made from that converted Roth IRA.
And if I'm not mistaken, the same rule would apply to an unfortunate situation like this as late as April 15th, 2014, that it would look back to January 1st, 2013.
Yes. That's correct.
Okay, that's a lot of words. Sorry, audience. Is it permitted in good tax reduction strategy to gift her own or inherited IRA accounts during her lifetime and avoid estate tax later?
This year, the federal estate tax exemption is $5.25 million. Okay. I think there's less of a chance one is going to be subject to the federal estate tax than one is going to be subject to income tax. So I think the fact that they're worried about estate taxes, I think is to me it's sort of overblown. I think it's really not to be concerned with. Plus the fact that if she does convert the traditional IRA to the Roth IRA, she has to pay taxes from an outside source. Like for example, she has a liquid savings account, a money market account. And paying the taxes cuts down the size of her estate. So I think the fact that the federal estate tax exemption is so high makes the federal estate tax question not important. As a follow up to that, I just want to say also that states have their own estate taxes. So if they live in a state that has a low state tax exemption, like here in Maryland where I live, there's a $1 million. Estate tax exemption. So depending on the size of the state, it could be an issue for state tax purposes.
Okay. All righty. Now, phones. We don't have a lot of time, but we'd love to hear from you. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Ed, I'm going to ask you a question. You can ask the same thing of me. You do an awful lot of tax returns. What would be a common comment you'd make to a client after the process is done to help them and actually to help you?
What I tell the clients is the easiest thing to do is to put numbers on a tax return. That's the easy part. The hard part is planning. Look ahead. You know, as far like, for example, we're preparing 2012 taxes right now. The damage has sort of been done. We can't undo what's already been done. But we have to look ahead for 2013. Okay, as far as taxes are concerned, so that we can minimize the amount of taxes we're going to pay for 2013. And there have been some changes in the law for 2013, so I have to go over that with the client because some clients say, well, my income is going to be less, therefore I don't have to be concerned about 2013 taxes. Well, that's not necessarily true. Taxes are going to be less. Many federal employees think that their taxes are going to go down after they retire. I'm not so sure. And that brings us sort of to a planning question as far as the TSP is concerned. One of the most often asked questions I get in class when I do the benefits presentations is, what's a better deal, putting money into the traditional TSP so this way I get my tax savings now, or should I do the Roth TSP and do my tax savings get my tax savings later? What's better? Well, my standard answer is definite, unqualified, no questions asked, it all depends. It all depends. You got to look ahead of here. What's going to happen after you retire? Where are you going to be living? You know, you might be living in a state that has a low income tax, maybe no sales tax, and no income tax. You have to consider what's going to happen after you retire. Where are you going to be living? And also, there's more taxes. We'll probably talk about this maybe a little later, about the Medicare surtaxes that are now starting as of this year. There are additional taxes besides the income taxes we're talking about. So there's a lot of planning that has to be done right now. My opinion is that Congress made changes to the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012, and I think as far as individual taxes are concerned, I think we're done for a while. I think Congress has done everything they're going to do for a while as far as individuals. I think most of the changes in the tax law are going to come from the business side, talking about reducing corporate rates, you know, and I think the people who are in business have to be concerned with that. But individuals, I think we're sort of set for a while.
Okay, and the comment, the best time to do tax planning is before January 1st of the year on which the return has got to be prepared. I mean, you can't do too much tax planning after the end of the year. We did as best we could to try to find overlooked deductions, but we really need to be on hunt starting January 1st, 2013 for the rest of the year. And I think we got a caller. We got a caller?
Yes, okay, sir.
Good morning.
It's such an informative show.
Good.
You know, I'm going to listen to it a few times. But I have a question on a different subject, and that is, I'm a federal employee, right? And so I have not paid in Social Security. And, but am I, you know, am I eligible for Medicare?
Ed?
I assume you say you have not paid into Social Security that you...
That is right, because I retired before, you know, before they... started taking it.
Okay, so you were a CSRS employee.
That is right. That is right.
You're not eligible for Social Security, but ever since January 1st,
1983,
federal workers have been paying into Medicare Part A. That's the hospital insurance. That's the 1.45%. They call it the hospital insurance tax. Since you were paying that for at least 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay. When did you retire?
No. I did not pay for 10 years. I paid for like 7 years. I've been retired for a while now.
Okay. Have you been working since then, since you retired?
Yes, I have. I have worked off and on, and I have completed the quarters. But the question is...
For Medicare?
For Social Security.
Well, I'm talking about because your question was regarding Medicare, right?
Yeah. So, but I mean, is there a different tax for Medicare?
Yes, there is. The Medicare hospital insurance tax is 1.45%.
So that you had to pay separately?
You paid that separately when you were working for the government between '83 and I guess 1990.
Yeah.
You were paying that, and then you went out and worked. You were paying both Social Security and Medicare tax, and I assume you worked for at least 3 years.
Well, what I was self-employed, so I paid directly to the...
I understand.
Yeah.
So, therefore, you are eligible for Medicare Part A, and as such, you're eligible for Medicare Part B, because you've been paying that Medicare tax for at least 10 years.
I see. Okay.
Now, as far as Social Security is concerned, you have to have at least 10 years of Social Security covered.
40
credits or 40 quarters of coverage, correct. That's a separate thing. May I ask how old you are?
I'm 69 years old.
Okay. Have you applied for Medicare Part A?
Not yet.
I'm
debating because I'm in the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan, but perhaps I might benefit from it.
You will benefit from it. I recommend strongly that you contact the Social Security Administration as soon as possible and enroll in Medicare Part A.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you're going to have to decide if you want to go into Medicare Part B, because...
That'll be next year, is it?
Well, yeah, actually, when you sign up for Medicare Part A, you're first eligible, which is age 65, you should sign up for Medicare Part B.
Okay.
Now, the only problem you're going to have is Medicare Part B, unlike Part A, is not free. You have to pay a monthly premium.
I understand that.
And there's going to be a penalty because you didn't sign up when you were first eligible.
I see. Can I ask one other simple question, and that is, if they have lost record of 1 year, like 1998 tax return, then how do I get it fixed? They say they don't keep record of that old.
As far as tax returns are concerned?
Yeah. I mean, I have saved, of course, my tax return and the canceled check of that time, but Social Security says they have no record of 1998 payment. How do I get those quarters back?
Oh, you mean as far as Social Security is concerned?
Yeah.
Do you have records of like wage statements, things like that?
I have the canceled check and I have the tax return, but...
Oh, so you're saying when you filed your taxes in 1998?
Yeah. They tell me that they don't keep track of tax that old. I wanted to get a copy of the official copy from IRS, and they say they can't provide me one.
You don't have your own copy, do you?
I do have my own copy, and I have canceled check also.
So you
would that be sufficient?
Yeah, I mean you have to go down to an IRS office.
I understand that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You thanks for calling.
Show. I appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you.
Bye bye.
All righty, Ed. I feel bad. I didn't mention that you're on the station every week, aren't you?
Every other Friday morning.
Yeah, and what time and
at
where?
About 8:30 with on the Federal Drive with Tom and Emily.
Okay,
just interview.
All right, great. And you're also a prolific writer.
I write for the Federal Employees News Digest. I write a column called the Informed Investor Column. And anyone out there who has questions about federal employee benefits, taxes, financial planning, the Federal Employees News Digest has a website. It's called Federal Soup, like soup, federal, it's soup, soup.com, in which you can send questions to me about anything regarding federal employee benefits, taxes, financial planning. And it's a free service. You can always ask me questions. Go to federalsoup.com to get in more information about sending me questions.
All righty, Ed. Let's wind up. We have less than 2 minutes, but I don't think we can do it justice. We've done the calculation, presentation, and filing of a tax return. What if it bounces back in the case of an audit? I mean, people think that they're getting audited, but in today's, they're called matching programs. Say, our records show that you didn't report this. It's not an audit. Either we did or we didn't, right?
Correct.
Okay. You'll know if you got an audit.
Correct.
Bring down a wheelbarrow full of all your records for the last 3 years.
Keep your records.
All righty. Andrew's given us the high sign, so we've got less than a minute. Final comments?
Everyone get organized for 2012 taxes, and please look ahead to 2013 and beyond, because there are changes and everyone's affected, both employees and retirees. Got to look ahead because there are some changes in the code.
And we didn't spend a lot of time with 2013 because 2012 was enough. So we'll do 2013 later. Thanks for listening, and we'll be on next week with Michael Creedon. Bye-bye. Bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.